So an essay in contrast, would the panel not agree, in the initial visual impact upon the retina as one enters these two galleries to Matthew Marks in Chelsea and Salon 94 on the Bowery. It's not my intention simply to offer a compare and contrast to those two shows. They really have nothing in common besides the fact that they're happening right now and we're talking about them on the review panel. But it seems to me kind of striking that one is an installation of several individual pieces, I'm talking about Sylvie Fleury, that nonetheless creates this very luxurious, sumptuous, in many ways OTT kind of utilization of the whole space at Salon 94 itself, already a rather precious and some would say exquisite space. At Matthew Marks, there's a strange sensation, isn't there, that you go into a gallery where these objects are clearly invested with a great deal of very private meaning, kinky meaning, intimacy. It's about whatever the show is about. At a certain level, themes there seem to be quite personal, private, interior-ish. And it's in that very quintessential white cube, sterile kind of space of Matthew Marks. Did you feel any kind of frisson of discrepancy, Martha, between the kind of the aesthetic experiences that Blake was attempting to trigger with his works and the environment in which one is to have those experiences?
Can I answer a different question?
Well, it's America. You can plead the fifth, but you'll have to square it with your conscience as to whether that's.
I just wanted to square it with you first. But I actually, when you showed the two together, I was going to say they don't have anything in common. Seeing them together, I was sort of thinking uptown, downtown. Do you want me to lean in a little?
Yes, please.
Okay. I was kind of thinking, I mean, in particularly the way I saw these was in uptown and downtown. But seeing those two together, I thought they kind of actually did have a lot of similarities, although hers is very sort of colorful and French, but most in the way that they both lean really heavily on art history, you know, so hers has this whole sort of like Daniel Buren, Carl Andre, Victor Vezzarelli, however you say his
Vezzarelli,
name. Vezzarelli,
yes,
I remember
yes.
how to say his name. Mm-hmm. And the Nayland Blake, which has these kind of like the one with the stool, it's obviously a kind of, you know, play on Duchamp, and these kind of Dan Graham pavilion things and the boxes and the sort of play with minimalism. In terms of the space itself, I mean, one of the things that I did find out when I saw the Nayland Blake, to go a little closer to your question, is that he actually made all the works in the space. So, and it was, they are objects that he'd collected over time. So they have a very sort of, and they were trying to point out one of the people I was speaking with there, that he was really trying to kind of sort of play around with this idea of site specificity. The white cubeness, I don't know, that's something I grew up with. Also, this image of that's actually a self-portrait of him in the kind of full leather regalia, in terms of trying to connect it with a sort of site specificity, that, you know, there used to be all leather bars on that side of Chelsea. Mm-hmm. And I did actually have a chance, like, sort of a weird thing, but you know what art critics used to do. I was having a drink with someone, they're like, come on, you can just come with us to this leather bar. And then you're like, inside, you're like, no, I don't belong here. So I have actually set foot in one of those for about 30 seconds. But so there was a kind of site, I mean, for me, it wasn't as disconnected. I do remember Chelsea before, you know, these spaces were all white
right.
cube spaces.
Well, of course, if one's talking about art historical references, it would be a sort of a double entendre of sorts. But the funny thing for me is that Elizabeth, seeing the artist in his leather cap and harness, kind of once one is ready to see art historical references with Duchamp and Dan Graham, it's one thing, this is Robert Morris advertising his show in the same issue of Art Forum as the notorious Linda Bengalis advertisement. But that would be, I think, putting the cart before the cart horse, because Morris was obviously tapping into an iconography, which in the case of Blake has greater authenticity. What did you make of the show, and how did you feel in the space where you were seeing the show?
I liked it a lot. The space, I thought it was really refreshing to see a show in a nice, beautiful white cube that wasn't too big. And I thought he handled the space beautifully. I especially liked the way he used the bathroom of the gallery. Mm-hmm. You know, merely by opening the door and putting that red plastic sheet, it, you know, just completely referred to Duchamp, and yet it, you know, it was completely sort of red light district. And all there was the regular bathroom that had some cans of paint and some catalogs and stuff on the shelf. And I also have to say that I have experience of leather bars. And I was once at Pig Night at the Lure for a great deal longer than a few minutes. So
mine was the mine shaft.
Okay. But that was...
not going to tell you where mine was. But of course, one doesn't have to be an aficionado to also savor that the leather or rubber padding of the door leading into the bathroom has a kind of torture chamber association with it. Hearn, of course, you're no stranger coming from the West Coast to all these antics. But any thoughts so far on Nayland Blake? What do you make of it?
Well, I also liked it a lot in terms of the way that I think that's good what Elizabeth said about the intimacy of the space and the way it fit with his sort of autobiographical approach. And I was struck, too, by the way that he used the bathroom, but then also setting up that big kind of, you know, the Dan Graham sort of thing where it was a compartment, but also with a mirror inside. So it was, you know, kind of his... bifurcated self-portrait and with allusions to Duchamp and everything in there, and then the horizontal sort of bar with the golf pictures on it. Everything seemed to have a nice formal connection to it, and then moving out with the flag piece that kind of brought the political, and I guess there's something to it, a little bit of the stuffed animal that has kind of a hood, like it's an interrogation sort of chamber at the same time, that, you know, it enlarges his identity in relation to larger sociopolitical concerns.
Yes, yeah. So do we pick up between this, the personal and the political, how does the work actually work? I mean, I kind of don't quite know how it works. I mean, well, I can see the ingredients and I can savor some intensity in their coming together. But in a way, sort of, if you're reading a poem, for instance, knowing where the references are and beginning to work out what the structure is isn't the same thing as having an experience of the poem. So could one of you talk me through the kind of pleasures one should be savoring? I mean, Martha, is there a particular piece that stands out to you as one that one could talk us through?
Well, I think, let's see. Sorry, I have to have notes. I'm kind of, you know, overloaded here. There's one called Buddy, 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 which is the one that's, I don't know if it's bisected, but it seems like it with mirrors, and then there all these little stuffed animals on one side that are shaped into a beard. So that's sort of a significant thing of, oh, because there's this whole reference to, you know, like bear culture and et cetera, and in, you know, whatever, gay culture. And then on the other side, there are bears with, there's a little plastic bag over it. And then there's a kind of sort of a Robert Indiana Love thing, but it's only kind of half scrawled on it. So in terms of the pleasures of it, I mean, I think that it has a kind of lightheartedness and humor. I mean, part of it is, for me, you know, individually, when I came to New York, I was right on the cusp of what I've read before. I mean, I have a lot, you know, I'm straight, but I lived with all gay men, you know, when I first moved to New York in the 80s, and there was a real switchover. Particularly during, you know, the what's been called the AIDS crisis, even though There's still an AIDS crisis in other parts of the world. But there was a very big difference between my generation of people where coming out as a gay man was a sort of liberatory thing, and people would put up their arrest records having to do with ACT UP and whatever. I mean, it was a sort of celebration. And for an older generation, which is sort of Nayland Blake, just a little bit older, for many people, it was a kind of, at least as I've read, I'm not saying this is a uniform thing, but that coming out was a kind of not so positive experience, that you now realized you're going to be part of this sort of like oppressed group of people. So I think for me, seeing a lot of this work, and that work in particular, it's got a lot of humor, it's got all these references to, you know, gay, if you want to call it sex subculture or something like that. But it's also, you know, inhabiting the minimal box. And, you know, minimalism was completely straight and macho from my perspective. Maybe somebody can, you know, correct me. So I see it alongside someone like Tom Burr, but that was very slick, kind of even more sort of like tasteful formalist work. And I like his work as well. But this one, I just think it, you know, it has all these details that have a lot of humor and a word that we don't like to use, humanity, in a sense. But it's a very sort of like humanizing and personalizing project in the sense also of minimalism was this idea of sort of, again, from my perspective, kind of democratizing the object by making it less personal. This is sort of reversing it. That's my take.
Yeah, right. That's great. But still, if you don't mind me saying, I mean, I learned a lot from that, and thanks a lot. But it's a kind of metacritical overview, and a very, I think, a very good reading. But it's not a sort of close reading, is it, Elizabeth? Are there objects there that come together for you that that could describe a kind of where it doesn't seem to me like a whimsical or quirky kind of collage aesthetic, but nor does it seem to have a strong, fierce... I mean, for instance, another artist who foregrounds his sexuality in installations that we're familiar with seeing at Matthew Marks Gallery, Robert Gober, a totally different kind of artist. But you're, while there's always ambivalence and intrigue in the work of Gober, there's equally a very strong kind of authoritative thrust of where this work is taking us. Blake, obviously, kind of more whimsical, right? More quirky and personal. But but this is no Joseph Cornell. So where do we go? What do we really get from this?
Well, I wouldn't call it whimsical at all. I think it's, there are a lot of references in the work, for example, to the fact that his father was black, so that he's biracial. And I was reading a few quotes from him, and I think the work also goes back to an earlier body of work that he did, which was called the Restraint Series. And there was one where he took a Breuer chair and he hung various S&M, like handcuffs and things like that, from it. And he said that that he was struck by the fact that S&M equipment and high modernist design use the same materials. And he also said that the real sculpture was not the object itself, but the idea that the viewer would find in their head imagining themselves inside this sculpture. And so, you know, to me, when I see these, I think his work is a lot about, and he also said that his sexual interests, which, you know, are clearly like bears and S&M and eating a lot, and he said that he feels that they have a lot to do with internalized racism and, you know, dealing with his heritage. And so I see this work a lot as coming out of, you know, these concerns and the little chains that he had in the black one that's called Spirit of 69. They're kind of refer to, you know, chains binding people together, S&M, and also to slavery chains. And then there was the little piece of, you know, which was an appropriation of the Robert Indiana sculpture, Love, which you found in a couple of the works, where he made a little version that was black metal and heavy and, you know, kind of giving it a twist. And I found that the idea of the pavilions, you know, they're more like shower stalls or bathrooms, I think, and they could also be museum display cases. But they, I think, they also relate to medicine, you know, and illness and hospitals and that kind of thing. And if you noticed also that there were, they all had little glory holes around crotch high, you know, so there was that as well.
Yes, certainly very multifunctional. Yeah. Excellent, but as you not in any way to trivialize the fact that you're pointing out that it's multi-layered and going back and forth between these sort of furtive pleasures and senses of protest or not so much protest but claiming the meanings of various histories which are of by nature and of necessity, kind of covert or repressed histories. Is that what came across for you, Han? Was it, did it require a little bit of a glossary to get through it then?
Well, I was calling up a lot of references and, you know, things I thought about, but I was just struck, I mean, beginning with the name, you know, What Want Ring, you know, with the way he reverses and plays with the letters, it's about that idea of identity, being born, if you're biracial and not heterosexual, you don't fit. Your inner identity is, as soon as you get into the symbolic level of language and culture, you don't have a place. You don't have a core identity. And I think I like the big thing with the photographs and then this kind of soft pink thing kind of sandwiched in between, like there's the veneer of the facade of the photograph presenting oneself and then this soft interior, you know, the wordless sort of feeling you know, the softness of the bear and the idea that there's this kind of, a primitive sort of sense, but then the bear is associated with the mirror. So, you know, I was struck by the fact that we look at ourselves when we look in there too, the viewer is incorporated into the piece. And you know, when you get into the center of yourself, you see, well, like you get into Lacan or something about mirror stages and an alienation kind of at the very center of your most personal feelings. And so that was kind of, I was kind of following that idea around. And then.
Right. So, and of course one sees from his photograph and from previous catalogues of his work, and also having met him, that it comes as some surprise to some of his friends that it's not immediately visually apparent upon meeting Nayland Blake that he is of African American descent. So it must feel, therefore, a sudden displacement even from the displaced, as it were. So that might account for the initially difficult, slow read one has of these things. Am I alone having a slow read of them, or were the rest of the panelists, were other panelists immediately and obviously struck by what was going on, or is it a kind of slow read art?
I think your read is slower than ours.
Okay.
I knew the work. I had written about it before.
I sort of felt a little bit, comfortable isn't a very good word, but it's not coming from a place that I don't understand necessarily.
Right. Okay. Good. Well, perhaps we'll be a little more uniformly perplexed by Sylvie Fleury at Salon 94. Certainly to the leather and the S&M. Well, there are bars here as well, and the bars are being bent, but they are literally and metaphorically golden bars. As Martha has already picked up on what I think even I immediately picked up on, and the press release helps you to pick up on, which is the references, no doubt witty and deconstructive, to the great male masters of a certain kind of conceptual and minimal art, the Carl Andre tile piece on the floor, the Daniel Buren, the stripes repeated around, the neon lights also kind of referencing any number of neonists among the modern canon, from Flavin to Naumann, etc. What does this all add up to, Hearn? Do you have a take on Fleury?
Well, I guess a take that I came up with after thinking about it a bit was that this is sort of a European feminist critique, where it's sort of an acceptance of a certain commodification of the female body, but also a kind of poking at the austerity of these male American artists who have to set up their idea of art, which represses sensuality and commercial allure and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. A sort of a post-feminist view, then?
Post-minimalist.
Right.
Another kind of post-minimalism coming from a sort of European perspective, although she's kind of, I don't know if I should venture into that territory, but I'm going to say something anyway.
Well, we have some. We have two women on the panel, so we could ask if there's a feminist agenda that's evident and obvious in the work.
You can do the feminist agenda.
I could do. Yeah. If you could be gay, I could be a feminist. But it so happens I am a feminist. So,
okay, good.
Good. Yeah, but I, apart from the high-heeled shoes, I didn't get any strongly feminist messages, and I'm not. I think we all know enough feminists in high heels these days to know that we're in enough of a post-feminist territory that really we're not dealing with necessarily a feminist agenda here. I don't really get the sense in the show of any agenda as such. It seemed fun. It seemed like good interior decor. I was kind of more interested in the. I thought the most interesting pieces. I mean, the blade I thought was quite stunning.
Yes.
But I think probably the most interesting work in the way were those crash tests. So you've got this John McCracken being referenced in these, the Californian minimal artist who loved surfaces which were akin to the gloss and the sheen of the aluminum of the steel of the motor car and of the automobile industry, and then a little expressive edge is given by the fact that they're panels that have perhaps been used in a test of some sort of crash, but did that give enough edge to give to set the piece alight for you, Martha?
No, I thought this was a very slick show and not a lot of substance for me. I agree with you. My favorite piece inside was the blade. And then I liked the video outside on the street, which was, I guess, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years old, maybe 1993. It's a video that only shows, I don't know, from the sort of like calf area down of people walking on a Carl Andre. I don't know, something about that seemed a little bit more, I mean, it was still a little bit slight as a work. When we were sort of deciding what to do, I mean, I was, interested in seeing this show because it's her first show here, I think, in 10 years or something like that. But it just, it's very colorful, very stylish. But I just felt like all the gestures were really kind of slight. So that's kind of what I felt about it.
Any big strong meanings to suggest to Martha that she might go back and have another look, Elizabeth?
Well, I think it was supposed to be slight. I mean, I think that's her aesthetic. That's her thing. She wants to be superficial and reflect the idea of fashion and consumer seduction. I think that's what she's interested in.
Right. So so it's ironic to then bring a pop aesthetic back to minimal when uh-huh. minimal was sort of sharing the 60s with pop and in some ways moving beyond it. So that doesn't sound therefore like one can be superficial and yet tap into one can deal with the surface and tap into something profound. It sounds like this artist merely, it doesn't penetrate the surface. It's just surface?
Well, emptiness, I mean, is profound, right?
Right. So it's a sort of J.G. Ballard territory.
Yeah, I think there are a whole lot of artists that are interested in that,
Yes.
Well, there's a kind of uncanny in fashion too. Did you you really liked the show?
I liked it. Yeah.
Oh, good. That's what we want to hear. Yes.
You know,
tell us why.
Put it on my top 10 list, but I, hobbled down those stairs with my boot, and I sat myself down in the director's chair because nobody else was there, and you know, I looked around and I enjoyed. I thought I just liked the idea of, you know, somebody walking around on high heels on the fake Carl Andre. I thought that was fun. Yeah, and the shoes were quite beautiful. I mean, if you thought about the color combinations, and the razor blade was incredible, and yeah, I liked it. I mean,
I wouldn't.
Yeah, I don't feel it's necessary to condemn it for being slick.
Quite right. I mean, we don't condemn things for being grubby, so why should we condemn things for being slick? I mean, Hearn, one more possible art history reference: the oversized. Razor blade puts me in mind now. I suddenly realize of Magritte and that room where you have the shaving brush as well. They could be brought together in some way. But Magritte, there's never any shortage of the uncanny. Is there uncanny in Sylvie Fleury, or are we on very, very familiar territory? I mean, what's going on there?
Well, I thought it was uncanny. I thought the total environment there, and especially going down the stairs, it was kind of a, you know, striking environment. And talking about superficiality, well, I mean, the razor blade may be all superficial. It was all surface, and yet through it you see the surface of the wall and the reflections of the wall on the other side. And I think for superficiality, she got a great deal of layers out of superficiality in one thing. But just going back to what Martha said, I was struck too. I was looking on the web and I saw that that piece had been in an earlier installation, and I'm wondering just about recycling the Carl Andre thing again. You know, is there a? I mean, she's recycling her own work as well as the work of the minimalists, and kind of that tends to give you another suggestion of a kind of superficiality. I guess is this going to develop, or is this just what it is? And
it may just be that. We in New York are not worthy of her best and newest and most original work. I mean, the poor thing, if she only knew she was going to be subjected to the review panel with four pairs of astute critical eyes on her work, she'd have maybe pulled out she'd have given us a Felix, some Gonzalez Torres sweets to take home, and then that would have been a much more profound work. Yeah, I thought it was great interior decor, but when you start with the Salon 94 gallery, you have to be a genius to make poor interior decor. I mean, it's such a stunning space anyway, and the stairs. I mean, if you just walked up and down those stairs, you'd be having an aesthetic experience. not of the same order as going to Salon 94 on 94th Street with their staircase, but it's the staircase gallery. Yeah, it just seemed, it was all dressed up. I was wanting it to go somewhere, ready for it to go somewhere, but I didn't get it, so I'm kind of waiting for the panelists to really illuminate it for me. I think I'm going to hold out some hope by turning the mic over to the audience. If there's anybody, we have a roving mic, and we have two shows to address, Nayland Blake, and Sylvie Fleury, and maybe we have the phenomenon if there is a singular phenomenon, that those two shows in some way encapsulate in their commonalities, their takes on art history, and the issues of gender or identity that they bring to their materials. So either show, any comments? Yes, great, good.
May I actually ask a question?
Absolutely.
I never heard of bear culture before. I don't know what it is. Could someone possibly comment a little bit on that, what it's about?
It's like big guys with beards.
Yeah.
You know, kind
big
of lumberjacky
guys.
It's the guys who don't want to shave their chest and grow the pecs. They've developed an alternative culture to justify keeping the bear gut and
nice
not
bellies,
shaving.
Nice bellies, yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's some...
Hairy, too.
Hairy. Yeah. Hairy is...
Okay.
Hairy.
Well,
absolutely.
Beards
and
stuff.
Just to comment a little bit on that, one of my problems with the show was that it seemed like it took so much information. I mean, you needed so much information going into it to understand it. I understand it much better now, but looking at it, it looked like to me, well, here's another installation that I've seen many times before, but I mean in different varieties, but I just didn't get it because I didn't have the background for it. And
I was thinking about this as I was walking. I was going to say, somebody's going to say, you have to know too much about da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And so I was walking by a movie theater, and I was thinking, because this is kind of one of the big arguments with, you know, contemporary art. Oh, well, you have to know art history, and you have to know all this and that and whatever. Although there's quite a bit of information on the press release, you know. So the thing is, I was thinking as I was walking past a movie theater, I mean, there's very little culture that we actually approach just completely blind. Like, you don't go to the movie theater and say, I know absolutely nothing about that movie title and I'm going to go see that movie, you know? You generally tend to know, oh, it's the film with the blah, whoever actress, or you've read a review or something like that. So I think, I was kind of thinking about that because both of these, the other thing is that both of these shows are the other, one of the big charges now is that people are so, you know, that the sort of recycling is hit. It's beyond postmodern pastiche. It's just like a complete recycling of references, and that's, you know, one of the downfalls of contemporary art, or that it is a sort of personalized narrative or something like that. So I don't know. I think that I'm getting more and more used to contemporary art working on multiple registers, and so there might be a way in which, you know, it's people are going to have different levels of information and also investigate as much as they want, I think. So
yeah, there's some shows that demand that you go and do some homework to get more out of it, and then there are other shows that you need some kind of guide to even begin to get anything out of. And also there are some shows, you know, there are some activities where the culture, it always struck me as amusing when I wrote for a newspaper that they'd say, look, when you start, when you write your first piece for newspapers, we don't want to patronize any of our readers. You can't assume art historical knowledge, and you can't, you've got to explain who the major artists are, and you've got to explain what the kind of terms, if somebody's taking on minimalism, like Sylvie Fleury, or Nayland Blake, you've got to first tell the audience what minimal art was, and then you've got to tell them how and why they're taking it on. And I thought, well, that's all perfectly reasonable, but you turn the page, turn three pages forward in the newspaper and come to a write-up on the latest ball game, and, you know, you don't, there's nothing in, I don't know the rules of baseball, but I don't expect the critic to give it to me every time, or the commentator to give it to me every time I read, not that I ever do, the write-up on the game. So it's curious that there are these different layers. But I my sympathies are nonetheless with the questioner, because it seems to me, and this is not a critique of Nayland Blake, because I think he, in a way, kind of does it, but I think that all kinds of artists come from all kinds of different places and cultures and preoccupations that have within them varying degrees of code or history and rules, and that in a way the work simply has to be compelling enough to lure you in and work out what the code is in a way. So, and also it can work. I mean, great works of art that deal with arcane. Sometimes, I mean, if you go to see the Magic Flute, you could say before you go to the Magic Flute, here's 100 pages you need to read about Freemasonry and politics in 18th century Vienna, okay? Or you can just go and listen to some very nice tunes and watch a funny story. So, I mean, is what was your experience with Blake? Was it, you're telling us that the experience is that there was no
Right. Aria. I guess I did not do enough homework, but to, even though I would agree that the Fleury show was somewhat superficial, it wasn't so highly, to me, personal. I mean, you get the references to André and to Buran and all of that, so that was much easier to sort of deal with, at least for me, whereas with the other artist, I just sort of felt, well, there's a lot of information that I would need to go back and read and study before I would really be able to get this.
All right, fair enough. Thank you very much. Great. Any other comments on either Blake or Fleury? Yes, good.
A question. The two panelists on the ends both used the word intimate with regard to Blake. And I wondered if you could say how you found it intimate, if you experienced it intimately, or if you found it an expression of intimacy. I found more a presentation of a world which the gallery guide helped me a lot to unravel. But could you talk about the intimacy aspect of it?
Well, I guess I was just picking up on the idea that it wasn't an overwhelmingly huge space, and that it was a space where one could present oneself in these multiple forms that interacted and created a kind of, interior dialogue. And then, now I was thinking too about the central cabinet with the mirrors, where it did seem to draw you in into the children's toys and the stuffed animal and the kind of, that's what I would call kind of intimacy, I guess.